The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Small Business, Big Mission, 2020 Hindsight and the Road to Recovery. The first headline for this collection of articles begins inside the Triangle Business Journal. From the editor, tough year means pivots to new paths. After COVID-19 hit, many business owners found a way forward despite the pandemic's enormous challenges. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee. And also, there's a note about this project. This project is the third installment of a series involving all 44 of the Business Journal's newsrooms, documenting the unprecedented disruption and the personal testimonials of small business owners affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. This leg of the series revisits the entrepreneurs, artists, and storefront operators first featured in May as the coronavirus upended local economies and pushed many small businesses to, and in some cases past, the brink of financial ruin. In the weeks prior to publication, we asked them to reflect on the year that was and the time-pressed decisions they made for the sake of survival during the early stages of the pandemic. We also asked them to look forward and offer an unfiltered view of how this chapter in our history is likely to shape their outlooks, actions, and optimism in the years ahead. Without a doubt, for small businesses across the country, 2020 will go down as one of the worst years operationally in this millennium. For most, it has been much worse than the Great Recession 12 years ago. In 2008, there were bad players in the financial services industry who caused the massive havoc on our economy, bringing banks, housing, commercial development, and capital markets down, and paralyzing our currency system to a point that we may have been a weekend away from then-Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner to pronounce that the dollar is worthless. Sounds bad, right? This year is worse. This year, for no fault of their own, small businesses are closing their doors by the millions because of the novel coronavirus and subsequent decision by governments, both state and local, that the best way to contain the virus spread is making people stay at home. The Great Recession mainly was a business-to-business meltdown. COVID-19 is a business-to-consumer calamity. What makes it worse this year is that we have further divided the economic wealth between the publicly traded companies on Wall Street and the small businesses on Main Street. The result? Large public companies are trading at historically high levels. Conversely, it is believed about 800 small businesses are closing every day. A Yelp report found 163,735 businesses listed on Yelp that were open in April had closed by the end of September. That amounts to about 800 establishments per day. Fearing a calamitous event, Washington lawmakers passed the $2.2 trillion CARES Act that helped small businesses by picking up the tab for a business's labor and utility costs for a few months. That was a good move and may have saved millions of jobs, but clearly, as we are finding from the stories told by four Triangle businesses in the following pages, it is not enough. Lone Rider Brewing Company, the largest homegrown beer company in Raleigh, is looking at absorbing more than a 50% hit to revenue for the year, which could amount to millions for the year. We survived, we're still here, but we are still very uncertain about the future, says CEO Sumit Vohra. For Zeb Hadley, his $27 million national coatings business shrunk to about $17 million in 2020. COVID-19 has set us back years, he says. But Hadley also remains positive that the worst may be over, especially if the economy picks up confidence following the release of vaccines. He wants to start the hiring process as soon as the company gets an indication that contracts that were mothballed are being revived. For John Ruffty, a Triangle custom home builder, things already have started looking better as demand exploded amid low interest rates and remote working. People were spending more time at home and realized they'd be doing so for the foreseeable future, Rufty says. And they realized their home didn't meet their needs, either from a family viewpoint or a work-from-home viewpoint. These are all stories of small businesses trying to find a way to survive. What needs to happen is customer-facing businesses, B2C, must see a rise in foot traffic. That includes restaurants, bars, hotels, airlines, and everything else. And that may not happen until there is a dramatic drop in hospitalizations and death rates. For that to happen, people must wear masks, social distance, and avoid large gatherings. Otherwise, vaccines alone will not bring those rates down. Communities will be fortunate if the COVID-19 vaccines are available before the end of the second quarter 2021 to all citizens. But small business owners do not have until June 2021 to stay afloat. They will need financial help from lawmakers and behavioral help from their customers. If either one chooses not to dance, your favorite neighborhood store may soon close as well. And the next article is headlined, Opportunity for a Wary, Wiser Nation. A pandemic lays bare the flaws and inequities of our workplaces. Will we, as a country, be better for it? And this is written by Beth Hunt, who is the Director of Editorial Recruiting and Development at American City Business Journals and writes the twice-weekly Work From Home Chronicles column. In an era defined by hyperbole, it's hard to overstate the workplace cataclysm of 2020. Tucked in among a global pandemic, economic calamity, widespread civil unrest, and a contentious national election is the universal impact that will endure. Here's what we know. The pandemic will end. The economy will recover. Civil tensions will ease. National politics will return to its regularly scheduled rancor. How we work, though, will never be the same, and that is not hyperbole. Some of what has changed is obvious. Gone are cross-country flights to attend two-hour meetings. So, too, is the idea that working from home should have air quotes as a euphemism for taking the day off. We're done going to conferences without weighing our attendance against our health, or taking meetings in person when video will do, or cramming into a bar for happy hour when a glass of wine on the deck is an option. Hotels, airports, convention centers, and restaurants will look and feel different post-pandemic, so will the industries they're a part of. Government stimulus has lost its boogeyman status. And shaking hands? Who knows? That's the thing. We just don't know about so many things. One thing we do know, much of the American economy, for all of its imperfections, was resilient enough to pick up and move home at a moment's notice in March and soldier through to the end of the year. Even so, enormous questions lie ahead as we close out the year of what now and tiptoe into 2021 full of trepidation and, dare we say it, hope. The biggest up in the air, of course, is when we'll get back to the office. And who knows what that will even look like. Google and other big employers have set a goal of July, which is still a moving target. And while most companies are still deciding quarter by quarter, it wouldn't be the first time a Google workforce decision was spot on. A bigger question might be what the office of the future will look like, because we can't even answer questions about the office of the present. We do know that companies across the country are reevaluating their office needs. Some are asking whether they need an office at all. Most are pretty sure they don't need the office they had when this thing started. This will be earth-shattering for the commercial real estate industry, the rest of us too. Working from home will emerge a vastly different construct. For many of us, working from home was a treat before COVID. Even companies with work-from-home policies kept close watch on those who took advantage of them. We now know that working from home is no walk in the park. The boundaries between work and home scarcely exist anymore. One bleeds into the other all day long. If there's one sliver of good news, it's this. Done right, the mix and mingle seems to be better for both work and home. It has also become crystal clear that many of the jobs that can't be done from home are either essential or expendable in a pandemic. When we finally emerge, this fact will beg some serious questions about how the American workforce is structured. Work-life balance will no longer be negotiable. There's nothing like a pandemic to lay bare the flaws and inequities in a system, as anyone who's had to manage full-time work and elementary school at the dining room table will attest. The lucky ones work for companies that made accommodations. Think flexible work hours and adjusted goals. Those who don't were forced to add more toil and trouble to the cauldron of 2020. If any part of our national reaction needs attention the most, it is this. We must finally recognize that our cubicle farms, organizational charts, and corner offices are rife with racial and other inequities and pay it more than lip service. Some will say we shouldn't conflate business and social issues. Smart business leaders know there's no way around it. The summer of 2020 brought about a racial reckoning in this country. To think that it won't follow us back to the office and demand that we continue the conversation will be the downfall of those who don't. We must no longer leave mental health out of the workplace lexicon. This has been the hardest thing to gauge in the collective American workforce, which has been marinating in stress hormones since March. The combination of everything 2020 has thrown at us, a deadly virus, a zillion kinds of uncertainty, kids underfoot, too many hurricanes in the Gulf, protests in the streets, fires out west, and yes, murder hornets, has turned us into one flaming, pulsing basket case in desperate need of connection and calm. Whether companies remember how critical this piece is remains to be seen. The ones that do will likely be where the best and the brightest go to work from now on. We've likely just scratched the surface of what we don't know about what's next, and chances are we don't yet know what we don't know, you know? In the beginning, it was all so new, unnerving but necessary, dark and dire with scary things around every corner. Along the way, people got sick, many didn't recover. Job cuts, layoffs, and furloughs were necessary. Legions of businesses didn't survive. The lucky among us have settled in and made our way with fingers and toes tightly crossed. Today, as the year draws to a close, we're weary, but we're wiser, and we carry into 2021 a resilience that is sure to light the way out of this mess. And we'll read one of the small business owner articles. Demand rebounds for his custom homes. John Rufty, Rufty Homes, Raleigh. And this is written by Caleb Harshberger. In March, Rufty Homes owner John Rufty and his staff were preparing for a rough 2020. But instead, Rufty has seen a surge of demand for high-end housing and has made significant investments for his business, including the addition of new talent as well as new business relationships. When COVID first hit, everybody knew it was going to be extremely severe both individually and for corporate America, and most people I knew of, especially in the industry, thought there'd be a slowdown, Rufty says. If anything, it's been 180 degrees opposite of that. His Raleigh company builds custom homes in the $1 million and up range. In March, Rufty saw five of five customers halt work on homes in the pipeline, so the company froze hiring. Rufty says the $232,000 he received from the Paycheck Protection Program lasted about 3 months, enough time to get him and his then 22 employees through the initial slump. Then business trickled back in. By May, four of the five customers returned, and Rufty fielded a growing number of requests as demand for homes exploded. People were spending more time at home and realized they'd be doing so for the foreseeable future, he says. And they realized their home didn't meet their needs, either from a family viewpoint or a work-from-home viewpoint. So Rufty Homes made some big changes. First, the company added talent with three experienced hires in recent months. All three positions have noticeably higher skill sets than you typically see in this marketplace, he says. Second, Rufty built new relationships with three different architects from around the country, opening up new opportunities and higher price points. Most homes in this marketplace aren't designed by true architects, he says. An architecturally drawn and designed house will typically be noticeably more expensive. In May, the most expensive home he worked on cost $6.5 million. These homes will be a bit above that, he says. Still, the pandemic has wreaked havoc on supply chains for materials, appliances, and parts. When the pandemic hit, many suppliers assumed this would mean a major drop in demand. Instead, demand for materials and parts exploded. Many factories were still upgrading equipment, and the ones that could work were hobbled by the pandemic spreading to the workforce. The delays cost time and money. When you count the money invested, it wouldn't be uncommon for the interest clock to be ticking. $9,000, $10,000 a month, Rufty says. Yes, a delay is an aggravation, but it also has a real dollar implication to somebody. Still, Rufty looks to 2021 with high expectations. The firm has six projects underway, with several in the design phase. We're investing in the future and feel extremely good about the long-term demand for the type of houses we build, Rufty says. The custom market will remain very strong, in our opinion. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Christmas trees are more scarce. If you waited on purchasing a Christmas tree, you may be in for a shock when you visit your usual spot to purchase a tree. One carry man noted that when he went to a local lot, there was nothing left but Charlie Brown trees, a reference to the skimpy tree loved by the Peanuts character. North Carolina, with its mountain counties that produce the Fraser firs, is usually a place of abundance for trees, and it's easy to take for granted. But the industry in the state is somewhat new. Before World War II, most North Carolinians cut a tree on their farms, and that was that. But as the state became more urban in the 1950s, extension agents from NC State University worked with farmers in mountain counties to develop the industry. The state now produces more than 20% of the nation's real trees, second only to Oregon in production, and the state's Christmas tree industry took off in the 1950s. But this year, prices are up and stock is limited as the holiday approaches. Part of it is demand. Given the pandemic and the desire for a bit of joy in the world, more people rush to buy a tree early. But some of it, too, is the lingering impact of the Great Recession. A Fraser fir can take 10 years to mature, and the recession put many in the Christmas tree industry out of business. So now, there's more demand and less inventory, meaning a tree that once was $90 is now $150. Then again, welcome to 2020, right? Durham home decor firm apologizes to Hindu protesters for its design. Spoonflower has issued an apology for napkins that had been criticized as highly inappropriate by Hindu protesters. In a statement posted to its website, CEO Michael Jones apologized to the Hindu community for the inadvertent misuse of Hindu deity imagery on some of its dining products. Among the actions we will take is removing Hindu deity designs from Spoonflower.com home decor and its home decor marketplaces, Jones stated. Considering that we will also be communicating this change to the varying artists, we anticipate this will take some time to achieve. We will also ensure that the Universal Society of Hinduism's sentiment is communicated to the artists. Raleigh Bucks national trend. Given the hardships of the pandemic, Biz was not surprised to see a Washington Post story about shoplifting being on the rise nationally. The Post reported that shoplifting is up markedly since the pandemic began in the spring and at higher levels than in past economic downturns, according to interviews with more than a dozen retailers, security experts, and police departments across the country. But interestingly, that has not appeared to be the case in Raleigh. The Raleigh Police Department pulled its reports for November 2019 and November 2020 for shoplifter in custody and found just the opposite. For November 2019, there were 73 incidents with a shoplifter in custody. For this November, there were only 19 cases. Copeland steps down at Commerce. One of Governor Roy Cooper's key picks early in his administration was Raleigh lawyer Tony Copeland as the head of the Department of Commerce, and the decision has paid off for the state over the past 4 years. Copeland is at home in any circle, the product of small-town Hertford in eastern North Carolina and a graduate of Duke University. He previously served as Assistant Commerce Secretary, as General Counsel at BTI, and as a partner at Williams Mullen. He started his tenure as the state's key recruiter only 10 months after House Bill 2 passed. In his role, he had to meld the desires of the Democratic and Republican factions while also working alongside the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. The state has had some misses, Amazon and Apple and automotive manufacturers in particular, but has seen a steady drumbeat of success over the past 4 years, announcing the creation of 78,877 jobs and attracting $1.4 billion in capital investment. Florida tribe invests in North Carolina. It's no surprise that national investors are jumping into the hot North Carolina markets of the Triangle and Charlotte, but one purchase in particular recently stood out. The Charlotte Business Journal recently reported that the Seminole Tribe of Florida has purchased an urban apartment property for $65 million. The tribe's headquarters are in Hollywood, Florida, and the tribe, thanks to extensive gaming operations and astute investing, is quite wealthy. That revenue has been estimated at $2.5 billion a year, and the tribe was contributing $350 million per year to the state of Florida. And finally, UNC graduate takes lead vaccine role. Kismekia Corbett, from the small community of Hurdle Springs outside of Hillsboro, has played a leading role in discovering the vaccines coming out to fight the pandemic. She received her PhD degree from UNC Chapel Hill and joined the National Institutes of Health's Vaccine Research Center in 2014. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. Back at the helm, Richard Dubrow buys back SilverSky, the company he once led. A private investment group led by a former CEO has bought a company from international giant BAE Systems, naming Mooresville as the headquarters. 6 years after selling SilverSky to the British defense contractor in a $232.5 million deal, Richard Dubrow is among a group of private investors who've acquired the cybersecurity business, pledging growth in the Triangle, where SilverSky has offices. Financial details were not disclosed, but Dubrow calls the amount fair. He says that when BAE announced it was divesting the unit, he began exploring options to get back in the game. I think there was sort of a mismatch in terms of culture fit between the company and the acquirer, Dubrow says. SilverSky was founded out of a group of companies in the early 2000s. At the time, it attracted the attention of BAE. Its sweet spot was small and medium-sized businesses, primarily in the financial sector. SilverSky was growing quickly with about 400 employees and 5,000 customers when it joined BAE as part of its global Applied Intelligence Division, a 3,200-employee operation. And there the focus became giant enterprise customers such as federal governments. The plan is to return to its roots. We're getting back to the core SMB, small and medium-sized businesses focus, financial institutions, and away from the super enterprises, Dubrow says. The company's roots and the culture were geared toward that, and so I think it was a stretch for them under BAE. Mooresville will be the focus of much of the growth Dubrow is envisioning. Right now, the firm has about 325 employees. We are consolidating more positions to the Raleigh area, he says. We're looking to bring more personnel into this location, so as the company grows, certainly the Raleigh area is identified as the location for that expansion. Most employees now are working remotely in light of the pandemic. When the team returns to the office, management will evaluate whether it needs more space, he says. Durham Group adds cash, eyes startups. Durham's SJF Ventures has raised nearly $90 million towards its fifth fund, a vehicle that will start deploying capital to startups in 2021, according to Managing Director David Kirkpatrick. The hope is to find the next Translok, a transit technology company that was acquired by Ford in 2018 and is one of SJF's trophy investments. SJF deals in impact investing, where in addition to creating financial returns for investors, companies are expected to make a positive impact through social and environmental outcomes. When the first fund closed in 1999, a lot of people scratched their heads and said, "What are you talking about?" Kirkpatrick recalls. But today, impact funds are commonplace, validated by major players such as the Blackstone Group and Bain Capital. What we do has now become popular, Kirkpatrick says. That would be why 122 investors have already latched on, investing $89.7 million in Fund 5, according to a securities filing. Kirkpatrick says the firm will meet its target of $150 million and could reach its hard cap of $175 million, depending on demand. SJF invests in early growth stage companies. With Translok, SJF led its Series A round. In the cases of other high-growth startup mobile health technology firm Validict, SJF was its first institutional investor. Its preference is to get involved after a seed round. We want the flexibility to invest $3 million, $6 million, up to $10 million, Kirkpatrick says. With the pandemic, SJF has cut down its travel significantly. SJF has been reviewing a lot of Zoom pitches, but it helps to have friends in common. While a recent investment in California-based Terabase Energy's $6 million round was made without meeting the management team in person, SJF was familiar with the group through mutual contacts. In the meantime, SJF's portfolio is seeing major successes, Kirkpatrick says. Over the summer, the portfolio saw its first IPO in egg producer Vital Farms. Wind farm off North Carolina coast progresses. Nearly 4 years after winning the leasing rights for a tranche off the North Carolina coast, Avangrid Renewables has taken a big step toward the construction of what could be the state's first offshore wind farm. On December 11, Avangrid submitted a construction and operations plan to the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management for the first phase of the project. The options are limitless, says Catherine Collins, president of the Southeastern Wind Coalition. One possibility is Dominion Energy, but it's not the only option. Duke Energy, too, could potentially partner in the project. New York tech firm shifts to Raleigh site. New York technology firm Phreesia has quietly shifted its principal executive offices from New York City to downtown Raleigh. In March 2020, in the wake of the pandemic, we prepared the company for indefinite remote work, the firm stated in a securities filing. Consistent with our long-term plans for remote work, we made the decision to allow our New York City office lease to expire at the end of January 2021. Filings show the firm has more than 16,000 square feet of space at 434 Fayetteville Street and a lease through 2023. As of January 31, the firm had 532 full-time employees. And finally, in a section called He Said It, a quote from Todd Olson, CEO of Pendo, on whether COVID-19 vaccines will be required for his employees. It's too early to say. I mean, I don't like that word mandate. It doesn't get a great reaction. We'd have to understand the circumstances. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Changes at the top. Longtime CEO Neil Fowler retires from RTP-based Liquidia. The head of a Research Triangle Park-based drug maker has retired, with his replacement coming from a recent acquisition. Liquidia announced December 14 that longtime CEO Neil Fowler has retired as both CEO and director of the company, though he has agreed to provide assistance for a short period of time to support a smooth transition. Fowler's replacement is Damian DeGioia, who has been appointed as the CEO effective immediately. He was previously the head of RareGen, a Durham-based firm acquired by Liquidia in November, bringing with it a pulmonary arterial hypertension, or PAH, drug ready for market through RareGen's agreement with Sandoz for its first-to-file generic of Remodulin. We are extremely appreciative of Neil's contributions to Liquidia as our chief executive officer and as a member of the board of directors during his accomplished tenure, said Dr. Seth Rudnick, a member of Liquidia's board. Neil successfully led the transformation of the company from a private early-stage clinical pharmaceutical company in early 2008, and we wish him every success in his future endeavors. The sudden change in leadership comes at a pivotal time for the company. Earlier this year, Liquidia filed for FDA approval for its PAH treatment, LIQ-861, an inhaled dry powder treatment, and is awaiting a decision. DeGioia holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Economics and Philosophy from the University of Michigan and an MBA in Finance from DePaul University. But the sudden change in CEO is not the only executive leadership transition the company is under. In late November, the company announced it was bringing on a new chief financial officer, scooped from Durham-based Arami Therapeutics, a private biotech that specializes in therapies for severe respiratory diseases. Liquidia was founded in 2004 by Joseph DeSimone. Its stock was trading December 15 at just under $3 per share. New leader for state's community colleges. The North Carolina Community College System has elected its next president, a Charlotte executive currently leading the U.S. Small Business Administration's response to COVID-19 in the state. The system's state board has elected Thomas Stith as its next president, replacing interim president William Carver, who has been serving since Peter Hans left to be the president of the University of North Carolina system. Stith, who was a chief of staff for former Governor Pat McCrory, is currently the North Carolina District Office Director of the Small Business Administration. My vision for North Carolina community college system is guided by the principle that education translates into opportunity, he said. The North Carolina community college system will lead our state's economic recovery by providing education and training for our diverse population. The system will become a national model for educational excellence, he says. UNC Health releases online price estimator for medical expenses. One of the largest healthcare systems in the state has released an online cost estimator tool it says will provide greater price transparency in the murky world of medical billing. UNC Health says the goal is to improve transparency for consumers who struggle with rising medical costs and provide more information to help inform their medical care and decisions. We understand the importance of price transparency in healthcare, CEO Dr. Wesley Burke said. This estimator is about improving our patients' experience and giving them more control in managing their health. And finally, we have a big number, $525,000. That's the amount of money Shaw University scored in a grant from a U.S. pharma giant to fund its center dedicated to the push toward racial equity. California's Gilead Sciences is giving the money for Shaw's Center for Racial and Social Justice, which launched this year, to further the development of a more just and equitable society. The grant will be distributed over 3 years. Shaw says the funding will help build general infrastructure and sustainability efforts for the center. Oh, and actually, we do have one last thing on this page, a picture, a snapshot of a woman getting a shot in the arm. Faye Williams, a 65-year-old retired nurse who returned to work at the beginning of the pandemic to help with the increased demand, became the first person in the Triangle to receive the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine December 14 at the Duke University Hospital in Durham. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Caleb Harshberger. Industrial space expands. Eastgate 540 project grows as industrial demand surges. A massive industrial park in Knightdale is gearing up for its final three buildings as sky-high demand for space has the owners on track to finish the park 4 years ahead of schedule. Charlotte-based Trinity Capital Partners will start construction on the final three buildings at Eastgate 540 after an incoming tenant signed on to all of the space in one building and with no sign of demand slowing for industrial space. I've been in this market for 20 years and I've never seen anything like this, says Jeff Sheehan, partner at Trinity Capital. We're going to be breaking ground on the final three all at once, and we expect to be done with our six-year business plan in just over 2 years. Despite the pandemic, demand for industrial space in the region has remained high, with vacancy rates at historic lows. The new tenant for Eastgate 540, Clayton-based PCX Corporation, works in the electrical distribution and power systems manufacturing space. The company signed on to 159,600 square feet of space, taking up the entirety of the upcoming building. The deal brings Eastgate 540's occupancy to 95%. With the third building leased up, Sheehan says it makes sense to start the final two, which will total 120,000 square feet each and are currently in the works on spec as the company courts prospective tenants. Trinity plans to deliver the buildings in July and August. Once those are complete, the park will total 980,000 square feet across six buildings, with 830,000 square feet of that developed between May 2019 and August 2021, according to Trinity Capital. Sheehan expects the final buildings to lease up quickly. Our outlook is, as hot as this market is, it's going to continue to be valuable for the long term, Sheehan says. Upscale Cary apartments sold for $49 million. A high-end apartment community in West Cary has changed hands in a nearly $50 million deal. The Connor Group of Dayton, Ohio recently paid $49.44 million for the 240-unit The Reserve at Cary Park Apartments, or $206,000 per unit. The property is situated on 11 acres at 4,000 Residence Circle, abutting Cary Park Town Center. Documents show new Harris Teeter in Raleigh. North Carolina grocer Harris Teeter appears poised to expand its store count in Raleigh. The City of Raleigh's Planning and Development Portal shows that plans have been filed for a new Harris Teeter at the site of a defunct Kmart at 4500 Western Boulevard. The plans would demolish existing retail buildings to allow for construction of a 67,000-square-foot Harris Teeter with the potential for 50,000 square feet for future retail use. The site is situated on 14.5 acres near the Interstate 440 interchange with Western Boulevard west of the NC State University campus. The location is down the road from another Harris Teeter at 5563 Western Boulevard. Matthews-based Harris Teeter, owned by Kroger, would not confirm plans for a store at that location. The property owner, Jack A. Sneeden Corporation, did not return requests for a comment. Developer plots new homes near Enloe High School. A Raleigh firm plans a 21-home community featuring open layout designs on a collection of parcels near Lions Park and north of Enloe High School. The Redeeming Development Group will have 3 single-family homes and 18 end units starting at $359,000. The homes will feature 3 bedrooms, single-car garages, and high-end interiors. The developer expects to complete the single-family units in February and the end units in April or May. And finally, condos with rooftop terraces to rise in South Park neighborhood in Raleigh. Construction is set to begin next year on a condo project in Raleigh's South Park neighborhood. Earlier this month, developer Stanley Martin Homes filed site plans with the city of Raleigh for The Gray, calling for 10 four-story buildings totaling 100 condominiums, 8 to 14 units per building, complete with rooftop terraces. The design will be stacked two-story condos with rooftop terraces overlooking the city. The project, previously called Carolina Coach, is situated on 3.2 acres at 1208 South Blunt Street. And now we turn to our continuing series, The Promise Of. The headline, Preparing the Digital Workforce. IT Services Group leader Tony Marshall is building a niche by filling the growing need in the cybersecurity field. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the project named is based on a historical reference relating to Union Army leader William Sherman's promise of giving 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 acres and a mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. There are more than 20,000 cybersecurity jobs open in North Carolina, according to CyberSeek, a project of the Computing Technology Industry Association, the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education and Burning Glass Technologies. That's good news if you're on the job searching side, but when you're a business with one of those 20,000 jobs posted and you're scrambling to hire talent, it's a tough market. Tony Marshall, president and CEO of Innovative Systems Group, saw the growing need for workers skilled and experienced in cybersecurity. So he launched ISG's Cybersecurity Apprenticeship Program in November 2013, although his company dates to 1998, when it primarily provided custom software to the forest products industry. Apprenticeships to provide hands-on experience in cybersecurity was a new phenomenon. When ISG started the program, Marshall says it was the first of its kind in the country. Not only was it a different model for developing skills training, it was also a different approach to the business of education, as Marshall explains. 85% of our revenue is derived from the work that our employees do while in apprenticeship. The problem with most current education models is that the organizations make their money by placing butts in seats and not by getting people engaged in work. Our revenue is derived when people go to work. We designed the model like this on purpose. It's a win for the businesses utilizing the apprentices because they are working under the supervision and mentorship of ISG's cybersecurity pros, but it's equally a win for the student apprentices who are paid roughly $48,000 a year while in an apprenticeship. Graduates of our program haven't made less than $85,000 a year, and of the graduates who are available to work, 87% are working, Marshall says. In the beginning, ISG recruited students from the military. The initial graduates were, on average, 43 years old, and many were disabled veterans. While the military continues to be a focus for recruiting, and ISG has an office at Fort Bragg as well as in Raleigh, they have expanded the search for students beyond veterans and enlisted service members. This fall, ISG launched a cybersecurity pilot program with the Women's Business Center of North Carolina, WBCNC. Aimed at recruiting and training young women of diverse backgrounds aged 18 to 25 in 11 eastern North Carolina counties, including Edgecombe, Franklin, Johnston, Vance, and Warren. The cybersecurity program dovetails with the entrepreneurship training that has been a mainstay at WBCNC. The mission of the Women's Business Center of North Carolina is to promote economic self-sufficiency for all women in North Carolina through entrepreneurship. We empower women by offering tools and support to establish businesses, stabilize their companies, generate sustainable profits, strategize for future growth, and contribute to the growth and economic development of the community, explains Roberta McCullough, Executive Director of WBCNC. The collaboration with ISG to pilot a cybersecurity training program will prepare young women for careers in technology. The plan, McCullough says, is that ISG will provide 30 hours per week of pre-apprentice education and training virtually over an 8-week period, essentially preparing them to become certified in CompTIA A+. They will then be positioned to continue hands-on training through ISG and its partnerships with workforce development departments in certain counties, she continues. Additionally, WBCNC will offer entrepreneurship training to the candidates over a 3-week period. Together, WBCNC and ISG will prepare the participants to enter the STEM industry as a career or as an entrepreneur. The program, which is supported by Truist Financial Corporation, will start in early 2021. The application period is through December 21, and the initial goal is to enroll 15 students. Rural counties in eastern North Carolina may seem an unlikely spot to recruit students for IT careers, but many of the jobs can be done remotely and can bring stability to some of the state's areas in greatest need of economic development. All you have to do is train people in IT skills, and the work can be done all over the world, from any inner city or rural area, Marshall says. I don't see poor people that have IT experience. That's because if they have IT experience, they aren't poor anymore. ISG's largest customer is North Carolina State Government, and Marshall says they provide cybersecurity services for a number of state agencies. Recently, they have also been contracted to educate, train, and employ residents of the Charlotte Housing Authority, which he says is in partnership with the Charlotte Area Fund and Charlotte Works. We have the need to fill jobs, but there's a skills gap, Marshall adds. Historically, we've not trained black and brown communities in technology. The ISG apprenticeship program not only trains workers, it fills another critical need by creating a more loyal employee, as Marshall explains. Apprentices become vested in the companies where they work. Employers are having trouble finding workers in cybersecurity, but turnover can be a big problem as well. Apprentices are incredibly loyal after you have invested in them. The role ISG plays is to invest in employee development on behalf of the businesses and agencies that it serves. Apprentices work as W-2 employees for ISG. If the client decides to hire them when the apprenticeship is completed, they can do so. It's the perfect try-before-you-buy scenario, Marshall says. We make sure the job gets done for the firm or government agency, and if they don't hire the worker, we help find other opportunities for our graduates. One of the strategies that has enabled ISG to procure more contracts is labeling their services as third-party value-added vendor. We identify an organization that has access to the customers we want to serve, but that lacks the ability to provide cybersecurity. We provide the service, and they put their name on our work product with a markup, which is a win-win scenario with the exception of the fact that we never build our brand, Marshall explains. One example of this is E+, a 30-year-old IT tech integrator based in Herndon, Virginia, with offices in Morrisville and Charlotte. Dees Moore, senior security consultant at E+, says the company, which works with some of the largest corporations in the Fortune 100 to small mom-and-pop entrepreneurs, has been partnering with ISG for 3 or 4 years. I wish more organizations could do what Tony does to bring qualified people to the table, Moore says. In the course of a year, E+ will typically assign 3 or 4 projects to ISG, each running 2 or 3 months. My hope is that more large companies will give small, minority-owned businesses work. Small businesses have to do a lot of work up front to show their value, and for the large companies, the biggest thing they can do is provide mentorship. I hope and pray as relationships grow that more larger corporations will groom and mentor minority business enterprises. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, Inside the Triangle's Nonprofit Scene. Giving rises in North Carolina despite a pandemic. This is written by Seth Thomas Gullidge. Despite a global pandemic and the economic fallout caused by it, North Carolinians continued to increase their giving to charities and nonprofits last year, if just by a sliver, according to the recently released 2019-2020 NC Charitable Solicitation Licensing, or CSL, annual report. North Carolinians gave more than $44.9 million over the time period. The report covers July 1, 2019 to June 30, 2020. That total is a $1.3 million increase from 2018 to 2019, meaning that while North Carolinians were not able to dramatically continue the trend of increased giving year to year in recent years, they managed to maintain and slightly surpass their charitable interests. However, despite the marginal increase in overall spending, it seems more dollars went to the right places. According to the report, a total 80.5% of all donations went directly to charities' programs instead of professional fundraising and administrative costs, a 6.2% increase over the year prior and a new record high. North Carolinians have responded to the incredible needs that we've all seen during this COVID crisis by giving generously and wisely, Secretary of State Elaine Marshall said. The record high percentage of overall donations going to charities' programs in this challenging time is a testament to our state's giving public and to the effectiveness of many great charities working to meet growing needs in our communities every day. Nonprofit leaders have also noted how donors have stepped up in the crisis. At Triangle Community Foundation, we've seen our generous donors and fund holders continue to give and recommend grants, especially in response to the pandemic as well as the nationwide incidence of racial violence. We've seen increased engagement and investment in our collective giving program, Fund for the Triangle, and in the nonprofit sector, said Lori O'Keefe, president and CEO of Triangle Community Foundation. In addition to dollars being spent in state, the Secretary of State's report also celebrates an increase in giving from national solicitation campaigns that included North Carolina residents. Such national campaigns reported raising $1.13 billion in total giving, an increase of almost $113 million. Of that total, charities netted 86.6%. The state cautions that the annual report does not look at every charity and nonprofit operating in North Carolina. It specifically examines groups that choose to use professional fundraisers registered with the North Carolina Secretary of State's office and that are not legally exempted from reporting their numbers. This report is not a comprehensive picture of charitable giving in North Carolina, but it is a meaningful snapshot of the state charitable solicitations in our state, Marshall said. However, the report only takes into account giving until midsummer, and with COVID-19 cases still spiking and increasing unemployment still pervasive, Marshall urges people to continue looking at ways to support charities. As we head into the holiday season, which also is going to be a season of intense need due to the ongoing pandemic, remember that charities are still struggling to keep up with growing demand, and they still need our support, she said. St. Xavier Center names Van Noppen new executive director. St. Xavier Center, a nonprofit located on Tucker Street in the Glenwood South area of Raleigh, has named Chance Van Noppen its new executive director. Van Noppen replaces longtime leader Sharon Hayes, who retired December 15. The center's key program is the Diaper Train, which provides diapers for working families. Diapers are not covered by federal assistance. The Diaper Train recently teamed with merchants across Glenwood South to hold a raffle and raise money for the nonprofit. The effort, through donations and raffle ticket sales, raised more than $50,000. And in the nonprofit notes, group that uses horses to help those with special needs holds fundraiser. A Triangle nonprofit that uses horses to benefit students with special needs is looking to grow and is holding a fundraiser through January 1. Helping Horse Therapeutic Riding has served special needs children for more than 30 years and is now located on a 15-acre farm in Wendell. The nonprofit now serves 63 students but has 15 on a waiting list and wants to expand its capacity. Helping Horse is looking to raise $50,000 in its Saddle Up, We're Growing campaign. All funds will be directed to the program, helping to care and feed the horses, and also allow more students to enjoy the services. Learning to ride allows students with special needs to grow both physically and psychologically. Donors can contribute at helpinghorse.org. V Foundation and Charitable Giving. The V Foundation for Cancer Research announced it has reserved a 4-star rating from Charity Navigator for the 10th straight year. Charity Navigator evaluates nonprofits across the country so donors can give with more confidence in the viability and effectiveness of a nonprofit. The V Foundation honors former NC State University basketball coach Jim Valvano, who died of cancer in 1993. The V Foundation has an endowment that covers all its administrative expenses, so donations go directly to cancer research. The foundation has donated more than $250 million overall. And finally, free sessions on building a healthy nonprofit board. Mission Triangle is hosting a pair of free workshops on the importance of board governance in the months ahead. Sarah Martin, the executive director of House of Hope of North Carolina, will host one on January 26 from 9 a.m. to noon and February 4 from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. The workshops are free and open to the public. The goal is to help nonprofit leaders learn the key elements of board leadership and practical ways to move the organization forward. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the editor's notebook. The headline, lots of bad, some good, mark a forgettable year. And the editor's notebook is written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor-in-chief of Triangle Business Journal. As I write my last column of the year, it surprises me that I literally have run out of ideas for what to write about. Sure, I can write about the Downtown South project or the impending problems with county and state budgets, or I could have opined about how the India-Australia cricket match in Adelaide may have a large implication for small businesses in Morrisville. I could have even pontificated about how ACC basketball is going to maneuver the growing problems created by the pandemic in the coming weeks following the holidays. But those are issues that require serious research, and right now, I'm just not in the mood to do that. Truthfully, I'm not in the mood to talk about anything for the remainder of the year. I'd rather move on to 2021 and take my chances that decisions I make in the new year will produce better results. 2020 will be hard to forget, but wouldn't it be nice if we intentionally and collectively decided to forget about the year after tucking in the lessons we learned of what to do and what not to do going forward? I am already there. So what lessons have we learned from the past year? I can think of three themes. Listen to experts. In any field moving forward, if someone has spent years researching a particular subject, listen to that person. It could be a data specialist, a clinical psychologist, a supply chain theorist, or a life sciences scientist. But ignoring or shutting down their viewpoints could produce a long-lasting, dilatory effect on our personal and professional lives. We don't know everything about everything. If we listen to people in the know, we will have more tools in our toolbox. People are resilient. Is there any doubt about that? For the past 9 months, I've talked to business owners who have seen their sales plummet. And frankly, in many cases, their businesses perished to a point that they are now left with a shell of a company. And what are they doing? They're figuring out how to reopen, revamp their business model, and empower their workers to work from home and make decisions on things that otherwise would have required a manager's approval. And millions who left companies or were let go from their jobs during the pandemic did not panic. They just started new companies. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 3.2 million applications for employer identification numbers, EIN, were received by the Internal Revenue Service by September, and that had already eclipsed 2019's full-year numbers. Impossible can always be possible. Just how many of us thought that working from home full-time for almost a year was sustainable for a small or medium-sized business? Well, it is. It may not be ideal, and there will be a time when employers will give workers a chance to return to work. But for now, employers now have the golden key to keep their workers happy by offering workers the flexibility and trusting workers to do the right thing for the company. I cannot emphasize trust enough. Employer-employee relationship in this country has hit a new level of trust, and that will result in an economic expansion. That's a guarantee. And I'm out of space to write about anything else. Good. Have a wonderful holiday season and Happy New Year, and thank you for being a loyal reader. In turning to general news, we have a story by Lauren Onasorge. Full recovery could take 5 to 7 years. Even amid predictions that the holiday season will bring 64% less passengers to Raleigh-Durham International Airport, RDU CEO Mike Landguth sees better times ahead. Speaking at a press conference from Terminal 2 on December 15, he said that, going forward into 2021, I'm feeling very optimistic. We do anticipate full recovery, all our customers coming back. It's probably going to take 5 to 7 years for that to occur, but I'm very optimistic about that vaccine. RDU expects to end the calendar year with about 5 million passengers, including around 2.5 million in the first 2 months of the year before the pandemic. In 2019, RDU saw a record 14.2 million passengers. Landguth said the airport is expecting a muted holiday, with 104,000 travelers projected for the Christmas week of December 21 through 27. That's compared to about 289,000 last year. The New Year's holiday, from December 28 to January 3rd, will see 102,000 passengers, the airport estimates. Customers will see more cleaning of high-touch surfaces at RDU, from handrails to elevator buttons. Blue-shirted RDU monitors will be stationed throughout the airport, and hand sanitizer stations will be well-stocked. COVID-19 has already struck the High Point market for 2021. This is a story from the Triad Business Journal. On December 15, the High Point Market Authority announced the postponement of the spring 2021 market from April 17 through 21 until June 5th through 9th. The Market Authority's Board of Directors voted to approve the postponement in response to suggestions from several exhibitors. "We're encouraged by the recent headlines about COVID-19 vaccines, but realistic about its impact on a spring time frame as the rollout will be slow," said High Point Market Authority President and CEO Tom Conley. "Coupled with the reality within our industry regarding supply shortages and manufacturing shipping disruptions, the board of directors agreed it would be most beneficial to delay spring market until June." The pandemic had already taken its toll in 2020, with the spring market first postponed, then eventually canceled. The fall 2020 market was held over 9 days rather than the traditional 5 in order to limit crowds and spread out attendance. Receptions and other social events were canceled, and seminars and workshops were held virtually. The fall 2021 market dates remain as scheduled for October 16 through 20. Downtown South wins key council vote, written by Caleb Harshberger. The long-planned Downtown South project proposed in Raleigh took a major step forward December 15 after the City Council approved the development group's rezoning request, but there's still a lengthy road ahead, and the developers say public funds will be needed to avoid a scaled-down project. Following an hours-long public hearing, the City Council voted 7-1 to approve the request, with Councilman David Cox the lone no vote. And we'll stop there, as that article just goes into further detail. And we'll end with the Business Pulse survey. The question: do you agree with Governor Roy Cooper's statewide curfew for North Carolina? The total number of responses was 313. 61% say no, while 39% say yes. And we have run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.